How did you start working on mega mines?
Mining takes shapes and forms in so different ways in Brazil currently. You have the issue that is happening in the Amazon of illegal mining in indigenous lands. You have the mega mines corporations that are taking over, and it's just expanding. Before, it was pretty much concentrated in two states, Minas Gerais, where I come from, and Pará, where a great part of the Amazon rainforest is located. But then I started because first, my home state translates, Minas Gerais translates to general mining. And there is not a clear understanding if that is just because of the amount of mines or if it is also because there are two parts of the state, the mining area and also the one that is more rural, that is called Serra Geral, that starts in Minas Gerais and goes into Bahia. And so basically, my entire culture is based on that, right? The rural living in one side and the mineral exploitation in the other. However, in 2015, when we had the first dam collapse that happened in Mariana, was up to today the largest environmental disaster in Brazil's history, everything changed. And it also changed for me, although I had started doing this research in 2014 because I moved out of Brazil in that area. And then when I was coming back, I was like, oh my God, I had no idea how huge the holes were becoming. And I started thinking that my home state looked like a Swiss cheese. So that led me, I was just starting in the photographic practice, transition careers from, I was working in the Argentinian government back then, and then government of Buenos Aires, then the city of Buenos Aires. And then I was transitioning to a photo career. And that's when that concern over the size of the mines actually became an idea, a research idea and concern, I would say. So in 2015, when finally mining got attention and actually the consequences of that kind and level of land exploitation were happening, I was finally able to kickstart doing the project and really flying over and having more support for it. And then what did happen is that when I started flying, I realized, and really looking with a critical eye, I was like, there's no way that there are not people impacted by this. So we were only talking about the impacts of people that were affected directly from the dam collapse, right, in 2015. But almost no one was talking about the consequences in the everyday life and this low violence that was happening in the community surrounding those megamine corporations. So that's how the second part of my practice started.
What are the effects of the megamines on people, on the landscape, on everything living in the area?
We have a very high rate of respiratory diseases because of the particulate elements. We also have water issues in many of those regions. So this was also a lot of the rocks are intertwined with the water. So when you explode the rock to get the iron, you're also blowing the water. That water is also going away. And we also have huge dams that need water, and the water process and the entire processing of the mineral making, it requires a lot of water. So we have extreme droughts that are happening in areas that were historically ecotourism locations. We also have the underlying social consequences of, like, whenever a megamine corporation installs itself in a place, like what happened in Conceição do Mato Dentro. We have a town that used to have around 8,000 people, and suddenly we have 8,000 man workers coming. So violence against women. We have gentrification happening in a very, very high rate. All of a sudden, the population couldn't afford housing anymore because the company came and started raising the rent price, you know, paying more than the locals could pay. So everyone started to being kicked out. And then you have the trauma level, right? Right now, ever since the tragedy, you have the trauma level of people living surrounding those mines, because they all of a sudden they realize their lives could be at risk, especially if they have a dam. And basically what happens with that, those environmental legislations, is that they have been under attack right, for the past, I would say, especially the past 10 years. So the idea is that those communities are now facing, also having the responsibility to defend themselves, right, with very, very little resources. But they have to go and rely on the justice system to do whatever they can to protect themselves. And basically, what I'm going back to the terrorism, it's so hard to get a license, and the community is able to have their voices heard through grassroots efforts, right, and using the legal, the Brazilian legal system, that it drags those processes forever. And what happens is that with the fear that was generated with the 2015 dam collapse and followed by the 2019 dam collapse, is that people are now afraid, as I mentioned before, suicidal thoughts, a lot of depression, a lot of extended fear of people living underneath those dams. So what happens now, there is this strategy that companies are using of saying, this dam is under the risk of collapse. It can collapse at any moment. So they evacuate and displace people that can never go back. So now they don't have the population there again. And by the use of fear, you're able to evacuate extensive amount of areas that now could be mined and can be researched. And that, and I can give an example. That's what happened in Barão de Cocais. So a siren came off on February 8th, 2019, right after the second dam collapse in Brumadinho. 492 people were evacuated overnight at 2 o'clock in the morning. They haven't been able to go back to their homes up until today. Nothing happened. That dam never broke. And still, they are decommissioning. They're emptying that dam, and they're just buying out everyone. We're talking about maybe 1,000 people in total in the all surrounding communities, sitting on top of a $60 billion or more project. You know, in a capitalist world, those communities are just disposable, and they are being relocated and completely dismantled, separated from each other.
So this means the mega mines are still expanding?
Now it's just expanding to an unknown rate. Well, the lithium mega mines in Vale do Jequitinhonha in Brazil are now mining those areas of the Gerais that I first mentioned, like that were the rural communities. And they don't even have that much water. So I don't even know what's going to happen with those communities. It's really sad because it is just an expansion unprecedented for us. And it's not only us, right? It's Argentina, it's Peru, it's Bolivia. A lot of those companies have a substantial amount of European money coming. And this idea, my newest project is about, is really challenging the notion of progress. Because what happens is that those mega mines come because they say, oh my God, we're going to bring so much development for this area. But you're not recognizing that that area was doing pretty well oftentimes. Oftentimes, those mines do not deliver high-quality healthcare or high-quality education or a public university. People that are hired in those mega mine companies are usually only the ones that are called terceirizados. They are the ones that are going to be the cleaning people and doing very, very low-paid jobs, the engineers, the high-level technicians. They're all coming from other towns, and many of them coming from other countries. So it's not that they are really educating local communities to have that kind of very, very high-skilled work level. No, they're bringing those workers from other places and just use the locals for the baseline that is very kind of basic pay.
Can you tell us about resistance against those mega mining projects and mega infrastructure projects?
In my experience, which is, as I mentioned, it's very mixed in Minas Gerais, the beauty is that the resistance is very often Women are the ones that are really able to be on the streets. They close the roads. They demand for more. A lot of them have been in trouble because men can be usually, their husbands are usually working. They're the ones that are suffering the everyday with their children. So a lot of the resistance in Brazil done not only in mining, but it also related to other kinds of popular movements and social movements, has a lot of female presence, which is really beautiful to see the sorority that is created in this way. It's interesting because historically, a lot of the resistance gets erased. Every history sells as if we didn't resist. We are always resisting. It is just not known. So for that reason, I love what I do, and I love being a photographer, but I have been trying to push my medium to further reach than its limits. And therefore, in my personal archive, you will find, I don't even know, dozens of people's voices and their stories that I later on translate through text. I translate through maybe other kinds of videos or more of a documentary practice that lives there, and those stories can be told with their own voices, because they have voices they often just didn't have the opportunity to be heard. And because their resistance can take shape and form, they know that they're not going to be able to win the war, but they just don't want to have the feeling that they just gave it away. So there is this beautiful song about the ants. And I have it at the end of one of my short documentary videos that I made for the community. And it says about the resistance of the ants and the collective resistance. So sometimes it will be by protesting, by, as I said, closing the roads, by going in front of the court when something is happening, by pushing the judges. It is also hard because those communities are being dismantled. Whenever you have like the 49 two people that were removed from their homes, each one is now located in a different part of town. So, and that is also an element that reduces the possibility of local resistance, just because when you're breaking down the community, you're also breaking down their force.
Is decolonial ecologies a term that you would say fits Brazil and how socio-ecological transformation should take place?
It is so interesting because you also asked about the decolonial ecologies, which definitely meets the Brazilian standard. What I feel is that I don't live in Europe, but that's a feeling that I have from a distance, that the colonial impacts are not thoroughly discussed. And one thing that I always refer to is this kind of ancestral knowledge. And one thing about the decolonial ecologies and the thought behind it is really also to have other kinds of thoughts taking into consideration, right? And one that I think, if you have now like David Kopenawa, and you have Ayrton Krenak, that are thinking about the relationship with the land, right? And the relationship with the land as something that is beyond you. When you go to the indigenous thought, it is mostly something that you're thinking about you as a point in a line. You are part of something so much bigger, and all your ancestors and all the people that are going to come after you. Right, so it's not only you. And when you have a vision that your presence is not only limited to 80 years, but maybe thousands and thousands of years, you can finally see that the mountain is a living being. And so going back and opening our minds to other kinds of thoughts, it is really important. And I think that's the first step to create empathy and understand that there is no such thing as a overwhelmingly right way of doing things. And keep imposing the way, just by imposing again a climate industry transition and an energy transition industry again on us, when we are the ones that are going to really provide all the materials necessary for that to happen. So I guess that's one thing that I would say: empathy and respect to other kinds of knowledge.